It is categorically simple economics, simple accounting, that when the federal budget, federal government is in deficit, that deficit shows up as a surplus, a credit to the private sector. Consumer spend, companies spend, companies earn record profit margins. The problem with it is markets have bid up prices of assets, let's call it the stock market, to levels on those really inflated numbers, as if those kinds of deficits are going to be a permanent and increasing fixture. They simply can't. Something's going to break here. We're already starting to see inflation become a real issue, if not mechanically, psychologically. And we're in a real tricky phase change. And perhaps the recent weakness in markets is the start of recognizing that.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. Stocks have sold off sharply since hitting all-time highs just 3 weeks ago. Bond prices are falling too. So what's going on here? Is this just a needed pullback to remove excessive froth before the market resumes rising to all-time highs? Or could this be a more significant reversal? For a professional's perspective, we turn to John Lodra and Mike Preston, the lead partners at advisory firm New Harbor Financial. And many of you already know that New Harbor is one of the financial advisory firms endorsed by Thoughtful Money. Hey, John and Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Adam. It's great to be here.
Wonderful to be with you here, Adam. Always look forward to our chats with you.
I do too, guys, and we have you on every week. We've seen a little less of you over the past week and a half or so. I think there was some travel going on. I had a couple of sort of special reports going on with the content here. So I wanted to just do a video just focused with you guys, really on that topic I just mentioned, which is, hey, what's going on in the markets? You know, literally just 3 weeks ago, pretty much, stocks were at an all-time high. All of a sudden, S&P is down, you know, cracked below 5,000. We're down over the 5% correction mark. The fear greed meter was pinned on greed. It now swung back to fear real quickly. So wanted to help you sort of demystify what's going on for folks. So I've got a number of questions here for you guys as well. I also want to get your reaction to some of the recent interviews that we've done on this channel, because I know you guys have strong thoughts about some of these topics, like the interview with former Kansas City Fed CEO Thomas Hennig. Real quick before I do, just want to remind folks, for all things Thoughtful Money, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com. There you can sign up for our free newsletter. You can get all our recent content, and you can sign up for one of our free consultations with one of our financial advisors if you so choose. Also, John and Mike, I'll give you a chance to talk at length about this in a little bit, but New Harbor has a special event coming up out on the West Coast, correct, John?
Yeah, that's right, Adam. We're fortunate to have clients all over this country, and most of our work with clients, even those down the street, frankly, has taken place over video meetings like this. But we thought it would be a great opportunity for us to head out west and visit with many of our clients out in that area. And this is just the first of several of these roadshows or summits, whatever you want to call them, that we plan to do to kind of get out and hopefully meet with some of our clients. But we wanted to open up to the broader community as well. Really, what we hope to do is bring an informative, educational program to folks who come in 10. It's going to be live in person. We're super thrilled, Adam, that you're going to be with us for these events. And we have at least for the first round here in California, LA and San Francisco, we're doing back-to-back. LA is on, it's a Thursday, the 16th of May, and San Francisco will be Friday, the 17th of May. And we're also going to have a special guest, the CEO of Van Eck Investments, Jan Van Eck. Van Eck is a longtime pioneer in real asset investing, commodities. The firm was founded in the inflationary episodes of the late 60s and 70s, I believe is the case. So they truly have a perspective on what we deem to be a really important asset class. We have for several years, and we certainly think in the years ahead, kind of this idea of real assets, inflationary type hedges, will be really important. He's a really fascinating guy. I think, Adam, your interview skills and his background will be a real treat for folks that attend. He's going to be virtual. He'll be joining by video, but it'll be exclusive for folks at our event. And They've even gotten into Bitcoin. They're one of the firms that launched a Bitcoin ETF. So our guests, our clients and guests of this event will have an opportunity to ask him live Q&A. So we're really looking forward to it. And of course, a good part of our team will be there. We'll certainly have a team here on the ground back home taking care of business, and we'll enjoy the time zone difference to make sure we can stay plugged in. But really looking forward to the event.
Great. Well, me too. And again, just wanted to make sure you let folks know that it was coming. And you gave them the dates. So March 16th in LA and May 16th in LA and May 17th in San Francisco. So folks, if you're out in that area, mark your calendars. Guys, I'm looking forward to participating in all that with you. It should be really fun. All right. Well, look, lots of questions for you, but I'm going to put you guys in the hot seat here because I don't usually ask you guys this question that I ask pretty much everybody else on this channel, which is, what's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets right now? You know, back to my opening question of, you know, what's going on? Which one of you wants to field that first?
Either one. I guess I'll try first, Adam. Yeah, I think we're in the end game, honestly. It's been going on a long time, and all central banks have gone all in on keeping this narrative alive, this narrative that really started in earnest post-1971 when we came off the gold standard. Now, careers come and go during this time, right? This is a long, sweeping path of time. Over 50 years this has been going on. It certainly has accelerated, in my opinion, in the last 15 years. In the last 15 years, we've seen central banks absolutely do things that are unprecedented and never before been seen. And we have reached what seems like this permanently high plateau. Stock market valuations are insane. Stock market capitalization, the GDP, has reached nearly 200%. Looks like it's around 180-something percent right now. Stock market cap to GDP. The Shiller price earnings ratio is in the mid to high 30s. Profit margins on the S&P seem to be permanently elevated at around 11% or 12%. Long-term, they're only 6 to 8%. It's only because we've had such ridiculous government intervention that they're at this level. And we've all come to accept that this is here forever, and that every dip in the market should be bought, and that every pullback in the market is an opportunity. And we're here to say that it's not necessarily the case. And we're not even calling for an imminent drop in the market, but we think the market is in the later stages, and ultimately a drop is inevitable. It's probably going to happen this year, in our opinion. So for those that are playing the game or trying to get the last little bit of rise out of the market, it's a dangerous game. And we do have to play that game as professionals, and we can describe how we're doing it and how we think it's safely done with hedges and that type of thing. But for most people, they probably shouldn't bother at this point. We're probably in the end game of a massive expansion on the backs of fake money, money printing. So what is going to be the comeuppance for all of that? What is the moment of justice, and what is it going to cost? Our opinion is that we are in a fourth turning, a climactic time in history, and that the price for all of this is going to be a high price, and that we will learn that the central banks have gone too far, and that they're not invincible, and that they're not gods. And the likely effect of this will be a pullback in the market that's much more severe than we expect, and one that lasts much longer than we expect. We can't guarantee any of this, of course. Nobody knows the future, including us, but we study history. We understand psychology, we understand mathematics, and we think the markets are likely to be quite a bit below where they are today a few years from now. The market should be 70% or more below here, below 2000 if you wanted to expect 10% returns in the S&P. So we're not anywhere near that. Every little dip has been rescued. We've had a vertical move and now a small pullback in the markets, which may or may not be an opportunity. We'll talk more about that. But I guess I want to close with this. This is literally the end game of this whole cycle, I think, or we think, over this next year or so. And that those that are in here passively or playing this game in here really need to be agile and know what they're doing with hedges. Otherwise, you're going to get stuck. And that's what we don't want to have happen to people.
All right, Mike, as I hear you talk, I'm thinking of this analogy. You tell me if this is right or not. But imagine like a wrecking ball, right? You know, swinging on a big chain. And it sounds like you're saying you think the ball is very close to the end of its current terminus to one side, and it's about to go the other direction. But because the ball is still moving in its current direction, and we don't know exactly when it's going to stop, it's a dangerous thing to stand in front of, like, say, go short, because there's there's still so much momentum carrying that thing there. Now, you're, it sounds like you've got a fair degree of confidence in your projection that eventually it's going to reverse direction, but it makes positioning right now a little hard because you don't want to bet against that, the weight of that momentum while it's still heading in this direction, but you do want to be prepared for when it shifts. Is that a decent analogy?
Yeah, Adam, using your analogy, it's like that wrecking ball is held up there artificially by something, either a magnet on the other side, or I can imagine, you know, a very strong wind from a huge industrial fan or something.
Or it's got a booster rocket, you know, two booster rockets, one's monetary stimulus, one's fiscal stimulus, trying to continue.
And it's become so normal. It's become so normal that everyone's kind of camped out right under the wrecking ball, having lunch, camping out, enjoying their life, because it's become pretty clear that that wrecking ball is there forever. If we believe in nothing else, we believe in reversion to the mean and normalcy and math and history. History says you can't have something for nothing. And those that avoid reality are ultimately going to meet reality, and that wrecking ball will come down. That's the hard thing about where we are right now in history. That's the hard thing about the job, is everyone says that wrecking ball is still up there. You guys are crying wolf. You guys are crazy. And we have to warn people about it because we know it's inevitable, but we don't know when. We really do not know when. But we know that we're drawing close in this fourth turning. It should be over in the next 5 years. Statistics or the betting markets show that it's likely that Donald Trump comes back at president. That would be a very fitting situation for the fourth turning theory, and that the, I forget the term, I think it's a knight that is always kind of presiding over these things. It's a lot of social conflict and tension in the country. If Trump came back, I think that would ignite that as well. And we certainly are not calling, we're not politically sided either way. But this is just what it looks like, looking at what's the reality and the statistics and the current probabilities. So as we enter this climax, a lot of things are going to happen that we don't expect.
All right. So John, Mike set, you know, a very high level macro table there that's probably going to take years plus to play out. Anything, A, you want to add to that? And B, in terms of, you know, current state of the financial markets right now, what would you add?
Yeah, so Mike did a fabulous job really painting the backdrop that has been present for many years here and will come home to roost. We have little doubt about it. And it's not just us. I mean, I can't wait to riff a bit later on your interview with Thomas Hoenig. He was one of the few folks in the whole great financial crisis during and after episode that we greatly admired for his vision and clarity and courage. Sheila Bair is another one that, you know, we could talk to, but he spoke pretty critically about overextension of the policies of the great financial crisis from a monetary standpoint. But he also, I think, rightly pointed to the fiscal situation, and that's become perhaps even the bigger short-term or recent magnet to that wrecking ball, perhaps. And let me just share you a chart here just to kind of put it into some context. This is a chart that shows the federal budget deficit as a percentage of GDP. This is going back to the 1930s. You know, obviously, we had a huge budget deficit in the World War II episode spending. But if you look here, the only time they even rivaled that is right now in terms of the percentage budget deficit. And, you know, this is kind of stuff that only happens during major recessions. We can call this little blip in, and the recessions are shaded here by gray.
And by the way, I wouldn't say major recessions. I would say major crisis. Talking about the global financial crisis, COVID, and World War II, basically.
Right. So we've been spending budget deficits like recklessly, like never before done. And as we've oftentimes made the case, your recent guest, Kevin Muir, made the case, it's pretty simple. We can get all complex about liquidity definitions and things like that, but it is categorically simple economics, simple accounting, that when the federal budget, federal government is in deficit, that deficit shows up as a surplus, a credit to the private sector. Consumer spend, companies earn record profit margins. The problem with it is markets have bid up prices of assets, let's call it the stock market, to levels on those really inflated numbers, as if those kinds of deficits are going to be a permanent and increasing fixture. They simply can't. Something's going to break here. We're already starting to see inflation become a real issue, if not mechanically, psychologically. And we're in a, we think, a real tricky phase change. And perhaps the recent weakness in markets is a the start of recognizing that. And we've got some data. We can kind of go into, you know, some of the more micro elements that have driven markets of late. And we'll get into that, I'm sure. But this is a huge backdrop that certainly should be for folks. You know, we serve everyday clients. You know, we're not here to kind of just talk about data and statistics, though we immerse ourselves in them to do our job. We're here to empower our, you know, empower our clients and viewers to not be caught blindsided here by these factors that are very much extreme and present and not just business as usual. So, you know, this is important stuff. Really should set a backdrop of folks. You don't have to run for the hills. You don't have to go under a rock, but just be mindful that there are distortions in markets that, if history's any guide, will rear their heads and you know, create a reversion to the mean, as we can call it kindly, that will likely be very significant.
Okay. And we put up the chart all the time, so we don't necessarily have to put it up right now. But John Hussman, who I know your firm and I myself have a lot of respect for, he publishes a ton of great charts. But one of the ones we pull up a lot is that scatter plot chart that basically shows the likelihood of future market returns given today's market conditions. And I think it projects, at least the last time I saw it, it projected like a -4% or -6% annualized return over the next 12 years, I think, right? Which essentially is a, you know, it's a projection of reversion of the mean, which is the market is so overvalued today. We pulled so much of tomorrow's value into today that the market's going to basically have to go nowhere for a long period of time to be fairly valued in a decade's time. Did I get that right,
that's
John?
That's exactly right. And John Hussman would be the first to say that, you know, if we don't fully revert to a kind of more normal level, maybe that -4% doesn't come home to roost, but you also shouldn't expect 10 or 12% annual returns going forward. You can't have both of those. It just mathematically does not work out. So it may just be, you know, we don't pull back as dramatically, but the rearview mirror of the returns we've seen in recent years should not be confidently extrapolated into the future, because it just simply mathematically doesn't work out.
You know, you were saying a few minutes ago that people are looking at the economic growth that we're having right now and the appreciation in financial assets in large part due to the net positive liquidity of a number of factors, but very importantly, that excessive deficit spending, right? And when I was interviewing Jesse Felder on this channel a few weeks ago, he really zeroed in on this and what he called the market is, too many market participants right now are doing what he calls extending the unsustainable, which are basically looking at these current trajectories and just assuming that they're going to continue pretty much in the foreseeable future, when a lot of this stuff, as you said, is extraordinary, it's excessive, it's not going to be able to be maintained, it can't be done without a cost. It eventually, it's going to have to be dialed down or revised given the pushback that we're going to have. And you mentioned the return of sticky inflation is one example of that. So you know, definitely hear your point about, okay, you know, it's hard, at least through your lens, to make a really rosy market prediction for the next decade or so. And okay, great. I think a lot of people can understand that. In the here and now, though, the markets, like I said, have just had a pullback. You know, nobody really knows, right? Is this just a correction of the bull trend that's been in place for a long time? And is this just getting some of the froth out and then we'll be back to new highs in the not too distant future? Or is this a topping process? And I should say, it's been a little while since I interviewed him, but last time Felix Zuloff was on this program, and he only comes out once in a blue moon to do press tours. But in his last one, he said he predicted that Q1 was going to be a barn burner of a quarter and that the economy was going to look a lot stronger than most folks had expected going into 2024, and that the markets were going to really party off of that. But then he said, you know, the wheels are going to start to come off for the rest of the year. If he's right, you know, then maybe this is the wheels starting to wobble on the axles, right? So my question to you guys is, and maybe John, we'll start with you, then we'll go to you, Mike, is how are you guys going to be judging whether this is just a short-term pullback, just a little wobble not to worry about, or whether this is the start of a bigger reversal, a bigger, more meaningful reversal?
Yeah, so Adam, we use a pretty diverse dashboard of indicators that we look at. Of course, we've talked a lot about the fundamental backdrop that we see. Valuation is really extreme, but that has very little meaning in the very short term. Valuations are a horrible timing indicator in terms of what markets are going to do in the short term. They're great indicators of what likely returns may be over a decade. But the kind of things we look for, and I think Mike and I would both admit that we have been more invested in stocks for the last several months since late this past fall than we otherwise would want to be just based on fundamentals. We have had a tremendously strong market from a momentum and even increasing breadth standpoint for the last several months. So we have had more equity exposure, and our clients have benefited from that. But we've done so with lots of belt and suspenders. You know, we have hedging tools available, and we can get into those a bit later. But you don't have to have a binary correct view on things. You can kind of have it both ways, not perfectly, but you can be every bit concerned about the fundamental backdrop and the likelihood of an eventual elevator drop, if we want to call it that, and still be more invested. So the kinds of things we look for, Adam, and we've got a pretty broad database and dashboard that we look at, are things that you might describe as breadth and uniformity. When you see narrow markets, like so much of 2023, frankly, we were very lightly invested because we saw very, very narrow markets. There were, you know, the Mag 7 stocks, and even through the end of October last year, the equal weighted S&P 500 was down on the year. It wasn't even up, right? So it was just the last quarter where the breadth really kind of widened. So the indicators in history is these are not perfect. They're weight of evidence kind of indicators, you know, creating this kind of, you know, jigsaw puzzle imagery, if you will. The more pieces that fall into place for further upside versus further downside really kind of gauges our assessment of the relative up versus down risk. So right now we're still seeing a fairly, you know, some of the short-term indicators, the overboughtness relative to 50-day moving averages and things like that, we indicated a very likely pullback. And we certainly have seen that. We pulled back just over 5% in the markets a month to date since the end of March. But we still haven't seen a broad deterioration in terms of breadth. And in fact, if I can just share a chart here, this just shows kind of the performance for full year 2023 and then various segments of this year. So first quarter this year, January through March, January through basically Friday. We're recording this on Monday, the 22nd of April. And then just the month to date in April here. So last year, you had the S&P 500 up 26%, but most of that return was three sectors. You had the communications sector, you had technology and consumer discretionary, you know, vastly outperforming. And that's what the green here. These are the sectors that have outperformed for the relevant time period, the S&P. Now, you look year to date for first quarter, we had some of those leaders start to fall. So, for example, the only sectors that beat the S&P were energy. And this is, again, through first quarter, through March, energy, communications, financials, and industrials.
Sorry to interrupt, John, but if it's green, if the cell is shaded green here, it means it's doing better than the S&P for that same
period. Better than the S&P, yeah. So what we're seeing, and just cutting to the chase, you know, the S&P was down through Friday, month to date, April, a little over 5%. And you had a much larger number of sectors that, even though the only positive sector really was gold mining stocks. They've had a tremendous quarter in year to date, but especially this month to date, they're off pretty good today. So no victory laps here. Even though these broad sectors were down, they outperformed the S&P. So we're seeing, in some ways, a healthy broadening of the market. In other words, not just these Mag 7 stocks or the very narrow sectors like technology that have carried the markets. So in one hand, these generals following the technology and whatnot starting to stumble is a warning sign, because those oftentimes when the generals start falling, it can mean a follow through to the broader markets. But we won't anticipate that until we see some, you know, breakdowns in the breadth of markets. Some of the indicators we look at, like, for example, bullish percent indicators, they have turned down, but they haven't turned down in a very dramatic way. Yet, if they start to, we'll start to take more defense. You look at the percentage of stocks above their 50-day moving average or their bullish support lines. Those still haven't flashed really red signals yet. Those are the kinds of things that we'll be looking for, just to name a few, to label this a likely more broad and follow through sell-off than just a near-term correction. Right now, I think we're tentatively and hesitantly calling this a near-term correction, but we'll look for some deterioration in some of the other indicators that we follow.
Okay. And, you know, we'll have you guys on this program every week going forward so you can update us on what you see. But right now, it sounds like you're not really trimming your long positions in reaction to what's happening right now. And probably, I'm guessing, more just sort of relying on your hedges that, hey, if things end up moving a little faster to the downside than you expected, you've got that insurance in place.
Well, we kind of automatically have trimmed our positions by virtue of the fact that much of our positioning has been with option hedges. So, for example, we had what I'll label out of the money put options on the S&P 500 that really were just kind of like a safety net should we get a faltering in the advance in the market. And over the last several months, we've been able to move those put options up systematically. So that safety net has been at an ever higher level. Right now, we have put options at S&P 4900. So just about a couple percent down from here. So if we got a major sell-off, that would take about 15% of our stock market exposure very quickly off the table because we have those put options. Another 10% of exposure that we put on late last year was through call options on the equal weight S&P 500. And essentially what that allows you to do, it's essentially the same as buying the stock and buying a put option. Right now, so we've been able to take profits in those call options over the advance of the market over the last several months. And this recent pullback had less sting because those options were closer to that at the money. So right now they're kind of right at a juncture point. If we get much further weakness, that piece of the portfolio will likely, you know, be neutralized to the tune of about 25% equity exposure. Gets a little complicated to talk about the specifics there, but it very quickly would take equity exposure off the table.
All right. So thanks for explaining that. Because I think it's a great visualization for folks of how a professional financial advisor uses hedging to basically bake insurance into the portfolio without limiting or still being able to take advantage of upside potential in the markets. And folks, if you didn't fully understand every term that John used right there, you know, you should talk to your financial advisor about, hey, you know, are we using these types of safeguards in my own account? Have them explain it to you. But more importantly, a long time ago for a different company, John and Mike, you and I, we recorded a free webinar for folks where we really kind of went through the basics of hedging. And you guys, you know, went into the details with a lot of charts about the types of hedges that you guys use. I'm gonna ask the audience right now, folks, if you'd be interested in seeing an updated version of that for the Thoughtful Money audience, please let me know in the comments section below. And John and Mike, I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but if there's enough interest amongst the viewers there, would you guys be willing to come back on and do that?
Of course, absolutely.
All right, okay, great. Well, look, we could talk about that forever, but hopefully that's for its own separate dedicated webinar in the future. All right. So, Mike, I want to come back to you. As I mentioned, there were a couple of important discussions that I'd had in this channel since the last time you were on and I had a chance to discuss with you guys. Probably the most important one, I think, was with Thomas Hoenig, who was the former CEO of the Kansas City Fed. And he was a voting member of the FOMC, and this was during coming out of the GFC, and Hoenig was, you know, he was sort of the lone dissenter there, right? He was the guy that thought that QE was going to create a lot of long-term costs that weren't worth the short-term benefits, and I think history looks pretty kindly on him now. at the time, he was really sticking his neck out there. So really enjoy that interview. So many people on this channel, ourselves included, have spent many hours opining about what we think the Fed is doing and how we think the Fed works. What I love about the interview with Honig is that he knows, right? He was one of the top executives of the system. He sat at the table at the FOMC when policy was being decided. He knows the people, he knows the process. So it's a real unvarnished view into, and true view into how things go on there. My mind was blown a little bit by some of the things Honig said, not necessarily because it wasn't what I expected. I think it was more because it was I suspected. I was kind of hoping that the decision-making process there was a little more independent, a little less politically driven, a little less short-term oriented. But Honig basically said, no, it's definitely influenced by, you know, the pressures of Capitol Hill and Wall Street. And oftentimes the Fed acts just for optics, to look like it's doing something, and hey, we'll figure out how to make it work later on. So yeah, it was very much appreciated, the insider honesty, but at the same time left with some real pessimism about how the system works. So anyways, I know you watched it. What were some of your takeaways?
Yeah, a couple key takeaways here that I just wrote down as I reviewed that, and I watched it a little while ago, so this is not going to be comprehensive. But you know, Honig said that if you grade the Fed on a curve, that we get an A, basically, or they would get an A. Or if you grade that the dollar is strong because it's the quote unquote cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry.
Right. Right. It was.
But I've been hearing that my whole career, and that, you know, that's going on 30 years, so it's. It has been true for that whole period of time. But again, this is kind of end game stuff, is our prediction. And it's tough. It's difficult to position for the future when things are so tilted and so extreme. But yeah, he said if we get graded on a curve, we get an A. If we get graded on an absolute basis, the Fed would get an F, right? That's pretty interesting coming from a Fed insider. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated Honig's straight talk, you know, criticism of the Fed. It was pretty neat to hear.
Yeah, like, and I tried not to make it, you know, hey, we're just going to slam the Fed for the whole interview. I did let him know at the beginning I'd be asking some difficult questions, but obviously let him answer it any way he'd like. And yeah, when he was critical, it was super impressive that a former guy that high up in the organization was willing to be that critical, and I think a constructive manner, of the institution.
Yeah, and he rightfully said the Fed's track record has been mixed. You know, they have nearly unlimited power, so it shouldn't be hard to be successful with nearly unlimited power. But even with that, their track record has been mixed. You know, I've been in this business since the 90s, and there's been three bubbles and two busts so far. And Alan Greenspan is on record, you know, probably the person who started all of this in earnest. He's on record saying the boom is worth the bust, you know, he said, after the tech crash. Right. And that's been their attitude ever since. The boom is worth the bust. In my opinion, is that it isn't worth it. The bust is painful, and it's disproportionately painful, you know, to the people near the bottom, or the bottom 40 or 50% of, you know, the wealth bracket. And so
I would even say that, you know, that statement, the boom is worth the bust, is increasingly relevant to a shrinking percentage of people. And those are all the ones at the far, you know, high end, high net worth end of the spectrum. And I would say maybe the top 20%. I could argue to narrow it down to the top 10%. I mean, it is, to your point, it's a strategy that works increasingly for fewer and fewer incredibly advantaged people, whereas the rest of the vast majority are getting left behind.
It's not right. You know, we've talked about this injustice a lot. This asset bubble boom has been completely unfair, and it's caused social tensions. It's caused people to be locked out of the housing market, and inflation impacts the bottom 50% more than the top 50%. The wealthy could lose half of what they have and still be wealthy. So it's not right. And I would argue the boom is not worth the bust. We would have been a lot better just plodding along in some kind of equilibrium without all this artificial intervention. So the wealth disparity is going to come back to bite us, I believe, through social tension, social conflict, as we enter the climax of this fourth turning. And,
I'm sorry. Keep going.
Oh, you. There's just two wrap up points, and then I'll stop. He also predicted that the Fed won't cut rates until inflation gets down to 2%. That was his hope. I think he's probably right. The Fed's not going to cut rates until there's some kind of drop or deflationary event. That's probably going to coincide with a big drop in asset prices. And in terms of when quantitative easing starts, he thinks a banking crisis would be the likely trigger for that. Well, we haven't seen a banking crisis. We haven't seen a stock market crash. The most likely thing is the Fed's going to stay pat. We're all so absorbed with talking about what the Fed's going to do next because we're forced to. But honestly, it doesn't really matter in the big picture. In the big picture, it doesn't matter. A moment of justice is coming. You know, a climax of this fourth turning is coming. Social conflict is probably going to increase because of it. And it all comes from this focus on printing money, and which has caused wealth disparity. So I love the interview. I love the fact that he's willing to call it out. And we never stop calling out the ill-gotten or the bad moves that the Fed has done over the years.
All right. And, you know, I think what was important about what Hanek said, and I think you said this too, is it's not just the ills of bad monetary policy that's affecting the future, but it's bad fiscal policy as well. And you know, Hanek said, hey, you know, we have to get the fiscal side of the house in order to get to a better future here, to change our trajectory. And then when I asked him, okay, you know, what are the odds of that? You know, what's the political appetite for doing that? You know, and he said, oh yeah, it's basically zero, right? So it lets us know that we're not going to change our you know, our ill ways until we're absolutely forced to, right? And we could pontificate, and I've done so recently with others, so I really won't do so here, about Powell's motivations right now. Like, why did he do the verbal policy pivot at the end of December, right? And why did he get the market so excited about rate cuts? And there's theories out there that he actually is worried about some sort of banking crisis, like maybe the commercial real estate, you know, time bomb is about to go off or whatnot. And he was trying to engineer a verbal rate cut, you know, without having to actually drop rates just yet. I don't know. You know, a lot of debate on whether he's more confident or whether he's more scared at this point in time. And we don't know. Time will tell. But where things ended with Hanek, the key takeaway I took from there was my last question to him was, all right, so what's the trajectory for the purchasing power of the dollar and other fiat currencies at this time? And he said, oh, you know, continued downward and probably at an accelerating rate, right? Unless we change our trajectories, which highly unlikely looks like we're going to do anytime soon, right? So this is where I feel like your guys' job, you know, becomes so critical, because really what your job is it's to protect and grow wealth. And essentially it's to protect and grow the purchasing power of people's wealth. So you guys are the average investors, you guys meaning the profession of professional financial advisors, you guys are the main defense for, you know, the average person against the trend that Hanek confidently predicted, which is that, hey, yeah, the purchasing power of our money is just going to continue to deteriorate until we get our heads together, which is not going to happen anytime soon. So yeah. I want to give you guys a chance to comment on that. And I know that, you know, that's one of the reasons why you're so into precious metals and hard assets and commodities is part of all that. But John, do you indeed see it that clearly?
Yeah, we do think that's a key, you know, it's one of the most important parts of our job. You know, the money that clients entrust to us represents lots of years of sacrifice and hard work. And it's really, it's there not to be on a broker statement, it's there to fund their living, hopefully retirement or whatever their goals are in life. It's got to keep pace with that. So it is every bit at the center of what we do for folks. And let me just share, just to kind of bring it back to the last real inflationary episode we had, and there's been a lot of analogs, is today going to be like the 70s? You know, there's a lot of pros and cons to that argument. But this looks at the 1970s. And the both the nominal and the inflation adjusted real returns for different assets. Now, first off, when you think of most folks and how they invest their money, and certainly Wall Street endorses this, It's mostly just, hey, what's your mix of stocks and bonds? You know, maybe throw a percent or two of commodities or things around the edges, but you know, stocks and bonds are the workhorses of what you should have, and it's really just a function of your age. Well, you look at the 70s and both stocks, S&P 500 and treasury bonds, lost money on an inflation adjusted basis. What did well? Things like commodities, you know, gold did well, energy, you know, real assets. These are the things that really give rise to inflation. So not suggesting that the 70s and today are going to be the same, but it really does speak to this, the same, you know, there are phases of the markets where what do well in a disinflationary or stable inflation market are horrible investments during an inflationary market. You know, I did want to call out that just President Honig was also on the FDIC, and he I think put his odds at a banking crisis at or the stability of the financial system, banking system, at 3.5 to 4%, 5 being the least stable. So he certainly sees the, you know, material likelihood of a banking crisis, and this I think ties into the whole conversation on interest rates. You know, we have a very modest allocation to longer term bonds. Our target allocation to longer term treasuries is like 7.5%. We just added about 2.5% within the last week with the recent sell-off in bonds. But we think there's a really good chance we could take out, you know, 5% again on treasuries, because we have this real challenging issue of the economy's kind of showing signs of heating up again. You have this fiscal issue that we talked about. The Fed last year issued a record percentage of T-bills versus coupon-paying bonds. That can't happen for long. You know, they've got to start to extend out the curve, and time that with a growing wall of maturing corporate debt, and you have this potential supply issue of too much bond paper hitting the market at one time. That may very well be the thing that gives rise to a banking crisis. You know, we saw in March of 23 exactly that. You know, interest rates on bonds rose, and banks had solvency problems, or liquidity problems, I should say. That very well may be, you know, what gives rise to ultimately a subsequent drop in rates and the Fed cutting and doing QE and things like that.
Well, let me get your thoughts on this then. This is one of the other questions I had for you. So another recent interview I did was with Darius Dale, who, you know, I've been interviewing Darius now for 2 years or so. And I got to say, he was spookily on for most of last year in his calls. And coming into 2024, he had said that his model, which kind of has about a 3-month forward looking duration, he said was about the bullish he's ever seen it, the most bullish he's ever seen it. And so he was saying, you know, Q1's going to be, you know, a heck of a good quarter for assets. And it was. So coming into Q2, he says his model is still bullish, but it kind of has these four regimes that it takes into account. And it says we've now moved from Goldilocks to reflation. So I think it's got Goldilocks, reflation, inflation, and disinflation. I think those are the four ones. Or maybe it's deflation, I can't remember which. So he says we've transitioned from Goldilocks to reflation. He's still bullish. He's just more guardedly so right now. And as part of his analysis, he said, look, with the latest March CPI print, he said the immaculate disinflation narrative, he thinks, is now dead. And so he thinks inflation is going to be stickier for a while, and that we may actually, the next regime change maybe from reflation into actual inflation. Now, whether sticky inflation is going to persist for a lot longer than, you know, the Fed wants and markets currently expect, or whether we're going into disinflation, that deflation may become the problem. That, I've been saying this a lot recently, but that's the greatest divide amongst the folks that I interview right now. There's roughly about half on team higher inflation and roughly half on team disinflation. I'm curious if you guys have an opinion. And whatever your opinion is, you guys have to remain positioned just for whatever happens, right? So how are you guys tackling this?
Yeah, I'll offer a take, and Mike certainly add to this. We think both scenarios will happen. We think probably like Dr. Honig that the Fed is ultimately going to go back to QE. That genie's out of the bottle, and we're going back there again. But it likely won't happen until after a major event in markets. So we think in the near term, we're going to likely see sticky inflation and maybe a reflation to a pinch point where we get a bear steepening in the bond, in the yield curve that starts to, you know, crimp, you know, I think it was Kevin Muir talked about, hey, you know, we're getting to the point here where pension funds can actually just put a bunch of their stuff in bonds and have a guaranteed return that kind of meets their bogey, right? And so there is this real thing of if yields go higher, which they likely will in the near term, it starts to put pressure on the stock market. And we think the Fed is not going to move and markets won't sell off until something breaks here a little bit. And in fact, if you look right now, the almost universal consensus right now is a no landing. You know, went from soft landing to no landing, right? That's like if you look at what the market is pricing in, that is the consensus. Kind of reminds me of everybody thought a recession was certain at the end of 2022, right? I've got some charts here I can show you, but the markets we don't think have reconciled this change in expectations on rates. So let me just shine a couple screens here. This is quickly a plot of this is what's called the CME FedWatch tool, and it shows the probability at the June Fed meeting of the rate staying at the current level of 5.25 to 5.5. For much of late last year and up until February this year, the market assumed with 100% probability the Fed will have cut by the June meeting. That's why this was zero down here. 0% on this chart means 100% likelihood of cut. Right now, as of Friday, there's only about a 19% chance by the market that the Fed will cut at June. So there's been a massive change. And in fact, this is a chart I just found on Bloomberg. You know, there's actually the market has a greater assigned probability to hikes or no cuts than three cuts, which was the consensus late last year. Yep. This is a massive sea change. And yet here's a chart also from Bloomberg that shows, you know, how there's been a deviation here in the stock market relative to expectations. This basically here is this declining red shows the market's expectations of rate cuts have come off, yet the stock market had continued to rise. This is before this month's to date sell-off. But there's a pretty dramatic divide there that we think still has yet to get priced into markets.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought those specific Bloomberg charts up, John, just because I was showing them last week, recording my interview with Simon White from Bloomberg, who I think perhaps maybe even put a few of those charts together. Yep. That interview is going live 2 days after this one. So folks, if you're watching this, if you found those charts interesting, we go into them really deeply with Simon coming up here. And maybe, John, what we've seen in the markets over the past couple of weeks may be those alligator jaws, you know, beginning to close a little bit. But who knows? I mean, the day we're talking here, markets actually having a really good run. So we'll see. All right. Well, look, we're beginning to run out of time. So I want to hit one or two more points and then we'll start wrapping it up, guys. It's fun, though, to have you guys here for a whole show dedicated to you. So we need to do this more often going forward. Mike, another one of the interviews I did recently was with Axel Merck and his team there at Merck Investments. And this was, you know, largely talking about what's going on in the precious metals right now. And one of the things they talked about, and I'm just curious, get any thoughts on this that you might have, is, you know, we dialed through all the normal drivers of, you know, what looks like they're pushing stocks, price of gold higher right now. And probably at the top of the list is central bank buying. But right under that was demand from China on the retail side. And, you know, one of the factors there is that China's had a really rough go recently. It's the retail Chinese investor there, right? Their real estate market, which I don't know if it still is, but, you know, up to last year was the largest asset in the world. Right, the Chinese historically invest a lot of their wealth in real estate over there. We all familiar with the ghost cities that have been built and whatnot, where people basically just store their capital in apartment buildings. That's been going through massive correction. Chinese equity market's really been beaten up, and so they're weren't many other places in China recently for money to seek safe haven except for gold. And also in the past couple of years there, we've had the creation of the Shanghai Gold Exchange. It's just become easier for people over there to buy physical bullion. So you kind of have this combination of their money getting beaten up in these other assets, and then the one asset that they've had, you know, centuries, millennia of familiarity with as a wealth protector has become even easier to buy. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot of demand over there for gold. And they contrasted that with the fact that demand, retail demand in the West still seems to be pretty darn anemic. You know, I know we're seeing these headlines of people buying gold bars in Costco and whatnot. But if you look at like the inflows and outflow or the net inflows into the major ETFs here in the West, in many cases, the money's been flowing out. And so love to get any thoughts you have on that in general, but of course it raises the question, you know, Wall Street loves momentum. And at some point, it's likely to look at gold if the current trajectory continues and say, hey, there's money to be made here. There's momentum behind this asset class. And those retail flows in the West could flip from negative to positive. And if so, that could be potentially a really big catalyst for future price growth for gold. So curious to get your thoughts on all that.
Yeah, you're right about those macro drivers, Adam. Central banks have been buying, and they've been buying in a big way for a long time. And now Chinese, as you mentioned, people in the public have been buying. They don't trust other places like, you know, their apartments in the ghost cities and things like that. But there's a lot of fundamental reasons why we like gold. Those are just some of them. The fact that it's disconnected long term from intervention from central banks. It's kind of like the anti-central bank asset is another great reason. It's one of the few things that you can put money into easily. Anybody can do it. A layperson can do it. And there's very low transaction costs, unlike real estate. So almost anyone can buy a little bit of gold. And of course, you know, Bitcoin is pretty new, and a lot of people say that's better than gold. But I think they can both do well. As far as gold goes, it's easier. Maybe I'm old school. It's easier to follow, and something that we highly recommend to all of our clients to have 5 to 10% in. But in the end, at the end of the day, you really just have to follow price. I mean, price reflects all fundamentals, and I'd like to share a chart and do a full review of gold and the miners if we can. But once you can see this chart come up, this is the monthly chart of the gold ETF, GLD. And as we've said many times here, this is the 20-year chart with one of the largest, most uniform and conformed consolidation that we've ever seen. And then a four-year consolidation with a nice inverse head and shoulders here, a triple top that did not hold, normally they don't, and a nice breakout over the last couple months. So picture perfect here. And it couldn't be better. Now, who knows if it's going to continue? So far this month, after today, we're down about $50 or $55 on gold today. We have a little bit of a pullback here. We don't know if this is something to be concerned about or not, or if it's part of a part of a normal consolidation. My vote would be that it's part of a normal consolidation. And a lot of people have asked, well, what about silver? Silver has been a real laggard. That's true. But silver started to break out too. It has more of a bullish triangle formation over the same period of time. And on a monthly chart, we've seen a nice breakout in silver as well. And if silver gets through this old high, we could see a lot of short covering right up to this level. And we could very quickly start to challenge those old highs. And silver as a ratio, or the gold to silver ratio, I should say, is still historically different than it has been over a long period of time at around 85 to 1. Silver to gold, that has been nearer to 40 to 50 over a long period of time. So that would strongly argue in towards owning some silver as well. We think silver is likely to play catch up here. And then lastly, I'd like to do a quick review of the mining stocks. You know, why haven't the mining stocks participated? I guess my thought is that they've started to. Let me go back to a daily chart here and then change it to one of the major exchange traded funds that owns gold mining stocks. So here's GDX. Back here a couple of months ago, the kind of the misery was palpable. There was just really bad sentiment in this sector, and all of a sudden it started to take off. And GDX hit a high of almost 36 a week and a half ago. And since then, we've had this pullback, and we're actually down a good bit today, over 4%. So the real question is this something to be worried about? Number one, is the gold and silver breakout valid, and is it going to stick? My bet would be yes. And number two, are gold mining stocks and silver mining stocks a good place to be as well? Because we have a 10% allocation to mining stocks, in addition to recommending that people own 5 to 10% of bullion itself. So if they take our full recommendation, clients are nearly 20% invested in the sector, even though that 10% bullion per se is in most cases in their own possession. But take a look at this pullback. So there's a downtrend line here that'll be clearer as I go out to the weekly and monthly chart. On a weekly chart, you can see that we've tried to break out of this downtrend three times. Each one of them has been disappointing. And now with this last pullback, it's starting to look like, oh no, maybe we're going to roll over and this is going to be disappointing again. We don't really know. Nobody knows. My guess is that this is a retest of this downtrend line. And this is a great place for people to buy gold stocks if they don't already have them.
All right. Lastly, technically, when you have a breakout, to really claim it's a breakout, it generally has to go back and retest that line, and that line hopefully flips from resistance into support, and then it can bounce off of that and move higher, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, look, 2 years ago, we had a breakout and then it failed. Last year, a breakout, not a strong one, and it failed. Each time, miserably retesting the low of that triangle, right? And this last time was pretty depressing. Even the most staunch gold bulls were wondering if it was ever going to get better. The moving averages, we've got the 21-day, or actually on the weekly, the 21-week, the 50-week, the 200-week moving averages, they're all flatlined here. You know why? Because this has been going sideways for years on a net basis. That means when we do get a breakout, it's going to be a bigger move. My guess is that the bullion is going to stay higher and go higher, and that we're going to get a catch-up here. Let me go out to the monthly chart still on GDX. Here's the triangle I talked about. Multiple failures. One, two, and maybe three. Is this a failure or is this a retest of the downtrend? My guess is that this is a retest of the downtrend. And if this trend up starts to assert itself, we could easily see 40s or mid-50s pretty quickly if gold stays up to where it's at. So that's why this lines up here. But so far, it has been a frustrating underperformance. I think this is a good time to buy. We're not betting the farm here. We have hedges in place on our position, or at least half of the position right now. We continue to bring in premium, sell calls, that type of thing. But I do believe the move is higher, and this is a great time to buy or add to these positions.
All right. Well, thanks for the walkthrough that, Mike. Gold continues to be a big asset of interest to the audience. I get pinged about it every day. All right. Well, we'll start wrapping it up here, gents. Very quickly, two things I want to just flag for folks. One, we already kind of gave a preview of this, you guys have your events coming up in, what were the dates again, John?
Yeah. So, LA area, actually in San Juan Capistrano, California. I believe that's kind of south, a little southwest of the city, if I'm not mistaken. That's right, Mike. And that is on Thursday, May 16th. And actually, if I can share my screen, Adam, just to kind of show folks, we do have a landing page for registrations. So let's go here.
Yeah,
so
where can they go to sign up for this? Yeah.
Yeah, so we can provide you a link. I don't know if you can shine it up on the screen, or we can certainly put it in the comments. Can you see this landing page here?
Yep.
This is for the LA one. Just gives you a little bit. So we got an 11 to 3-ish kind of agenda. So, and of course, we'll provide some lunch. Nothing too extravagant, but we'll hopefully make sure folks are well nourished and have an enjoyable time. We're gonna kick right off after lunch with Adam, you interviewing Jan Van Eck, the CEO of Van Eck. And as we talked, they're a pioneer in real asset investing, alternative assets, and crypto. He's got a fascinating story and really a great guest I think you'll have in him, Adam. And then we're going to open it up to live Q&A for the next hour, both of Jan Van Eck, but also the team at New Harbor. And then we're going to finalize, or the final hour will be just kind of some prepared discussion points that Mike and I and our team will walk through. But you know, there's a, you know, we are charging a very modest fee here. This is not a money-making event. We do incur some costs for the room. And I just want to call out, there is a early bird discount of $59 if, for folks who register by May 2nd. That goes up to $79 after that. So that's, again, Thursday, May 16th in L.A. And then, to be more correct, San Juan Capistrano. And then on Friday, the 17th of May, again, 11 to 3 in Palo Alto, California. Both really accessible from the major airports. You know, we hope local folks, but folks who otherwise might want to jump on a plane, come on and visit with us. We'd love to see the rooms filled. And we do have space constraints. We hope we get a resounding response here where that won't be an issue, but we'll have a full room.
Awesome.
So Adam, how best to share the link? Should we post them in the comments section here?
Yeah, I'll make it the pinned comment below this video, folks. So okay. If you're interested in clicking on that, just go there. And then related to, you know, folks talk all the time on this channel about the importance of folks working with a financial advisor. Actually just sent out a guide on this to everybody that reads our free newsletter here at Thoughtful Money, with a checklist of what you should be looking at when you're considering a financial advisor. And of course, even before that, you need to make a decision as an investor, which is, hey, are you going to be a do-it-yourselfer? And are you going to be the captain of your portfolio? Are you going to be, you know, the one calling all the shots, coming up with the strategy, implementing all the trades, staying on top of all the developments and repositioning accordingly? Or do you want to recruit a great financial quarterback to do all that for you? Right. So I think it's the first decision you need to make. And, you know, you're the best person to decide which of those two is the right decision for you. You know, as I say every week, I think the vast majority of people out there, the financial quarterback is the much better choice, because you've got real life demands. You know, you've got a job, you've got a family. A lot of people just don't have the financial education or the investing experience. And quite frankly, I hear all the time the desire to do all this. Right? They want to focus on the things in life that matter to them and that they're good at. They want to bring in somebody who's excellent at the financial management side, you know, to do that for them. So if you're in that latter camp, then highly recommend that the DIY investor, their focus should be, okay, what are the appropriate assets for me to invest in, at what valuations and what ratios? If you're going for the financial quarterback route, your focus should be, okay, how do I select the best quarterback for my team, right? And that checklist that I have available in our free newsletter, I think it's a good start for that if you're looking for help on that. Now, that being said, Thoughtful Money endorses a couple of financial advisors. They're the folks you see on this channel with me week after week. The guys here from New Harbor, Lance from Real Investment Advice. And I have them on this channel so that you can see, you know, they can serve as a model for you, at least set hopefully a high bar for what to look for in a good financial advisor. So either take their example and measure the people you're talking to against that standard, or feel free to talk to these guys. You know, you can schedule one of those free consultations I talk a lot about. And John and Mike, you guys, we were talking off camera before we get on here. There's actually some real, there's a good argument to be made for folks to talk to their financial advisor or to recruit their financial advisor now before the summer hits, because a lot of people kind of downshift in the summer, right? And given the fact that we're in this perhaps increasingly volatile time for the markets, you want to make sure that everything's kind of buttoned up as best as you can get it before you kind of clock out, you know, and turn your brain off and go to the beach as you deserve to do. You don't want to be caught unawares on vacation and all of a sudden having to scramble, you know, from the beach to try to address something that you hadn't planned for. Is that correct, John?
Yeah, there's an adage, sell in May and go away. It's a little cliche, and we don't invest by cliches or adages, but there is some historical truth to this, that the seasonally weak period in markets are May through October. In fact, some of the biggest crashes on record happened in October. The peak in the 2007 market before the housing bust, the crash of 87, you name it. They happen typically in October or in the fall. But the seasonally weak period is something to be mindful of. It's not always the case. For example, I think 2020 wasn't the case. But, you know, we have a a phase change, we believe, going on in markets right now that may be slow, but also very stealth here. And, you know, in a real sense, when we do our jobs well for our clients, they can tune out and have those vacations and be at ease that they don't have to be thinking about it around the clock, or they can go on vacation. You know, so please, folks, consult with your advisor. If you don't have one, we'd be happy to talk with you just to make sure you're in proper positioning, given, you know, where we are in markets, but importantly, relative to your needs. Many people are taking way more risk than they even need to satisfy a very rosy financial plan. So why take the risk if you don't need to?
All right. Well said, John. Okay. So, folks, if that free checklist I mentioned will help, go get that. Or if you want to have one of these chats with one of the endorsed financial advisors by Thoughtful Money, perhaps even John and Mike's themselves, you can do both just by going to thoughtfulmoney.com. If you want to get the newsletter, just click the newsletter link at top. If you want to schedule one of these consultations, you just enter your email there on the front page, fill out the short form, and these guys will reach right out to you. All right, guys, another great week. Folks, if you've enjoyed this conversation, would like us to keep, you know, John and Mike are going to keep coming on this program week after week, like they always have. But if you'd like us to also add periodically just a deep dive with these guys here, like we're doing today, please vote for that by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. All right, guys, it's always wonderful to see you guys. Thanks very much for hanging with me this week. Mike, I'm going to let you have the last word as we clock out here.
I just want to say thanks, Adam. It's been really nice to be featured here and to have a little more time with you and your audience. We really appreciate the opportunity, and we're very glad to be able to share our insights. I'd just like to reiterate that we're happy to do a free review for anybody that wants to chat. Anybody that wants to think about sell in May and go away, they're afraid to do it, or they want to have some feedback or just bounce some ideas off of us, let us know in the link below, and we're happy to do it. And thank
All
you
right,
very much.
Sounds Adam. Great. Well, thanks, John. Thanks, Mike. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thank you, Adam. Goodbye for now.
Thank you.